Hi there. Welcome to Extra Innings Covering All the Bases. My name is Albert Dabba. I am the host of the show. I am a filmmaker and owner of Simba Productions, a production company that I've had for over 41 years, and I am a mental health advocate. On Extra Innings, we talk about families, family relationships, love, mental wellness, mental illness, and how many people deal with the stigma of mental illness. We've had on many different kinds of guests on our show from all phases and all professions of life. Extra Innings actually comes from a film that I wrote, directed, produced, and acted in, and it's called Extra Innings, and it's on Amazon Prime right now. So if you have a chance, watch it, and it deals with my family relationships growing up in the 1960s, based on a true story. So tonight we have on our show Lisa Menichino. Lisa is a New Yorker, and she owns a lesbian bar in New York City called The Cubbyhole. And I'm having her on our show tonight because she has a very diverse background, and a background that I think is really great to have on our show tonight because it's Pride Month. And this weekend was a big weekend, a gay pride weekend. And I'd love to talk about that and her experiences in her journey of life. So, Lisa, how are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. So tell me about how you got to the point of, and one of the points that I saw written up in the news, I think it was the New York Times, about how there's only three lesbian bars left in New York City. And we were just talking about it. And I asked you, were there a lot more before? And you said, yes, there were. So tell me about that whole evolution of lesbian bars in New York City, how you got to own a bar, and where it's at right now.
Well, when I was coming out in, I would say early to mid 90s, there were, at least in New York, there was the good, I don't know, it had to be good 10 different bars or clubs that were lesbian. And I think there were over 200 in the country. I think what happened was, you know, the advent of technology. Well, let me preface this. It used to be that the bar was the only place that you can go to meet someone, whether romantically or socially, that was like other gay people. And I think with the advent of technology, it offered different places in which people could do that. And then as the gay community, as we assimilated, it was okay to be out at work. It was okay to go to a straight bar and be out. And so you can meet people that way. So the original need for a lesbian or gay bar kind of diminished in that way. And it's sort of byproduct of us getting more and more accepted, an unfortunate byproduct. And I think there's always been like a connectivity between celebrating our identities and the bar. You know, I mean, that's where we went. That's where we went to be together with other people like us. And so with the number of them diminishing, it's a sad byproduct of the broader good of being accepted by everyone. Well, not everyone, but you know what I mean. So that's kind of what happened. And I also think that the lesbians always looked at the bar as sort of like an old friend that, you know, it's always going to be there. You know, I'm in a relationship now. I have kids now. But, you know, if I, you know, a year from now, if I want to go have a drink, it'll be there. Not making the connection that they're our sustenance. Without them, without their continued regular support, we can't survive. And there's a documentary right now called The Lesbian Bar Project, which is bringing attention to this issue across the nation. The filmmakers went and visited all the 21 bars that are left and talked about this issue. And it's it's gaining in popularity and it's bringing this attention to light. And I think they're kind of getting it, you know, that you have to come. I mean, it's fine. You get married, you have kids. I know your time is limited, but, you know, make time for a drink and support someone in your community.
So how is it that you said before the show there are a lot more gay bars than there are lesbian bars? So why is that?
I think, you know, there's one component is the discrepancy in income. I mean, men always have always made more money than women. I mean, it's closing, but it's still there. So you have two men together, they're going to make a lot more money in general than two women. So they've had more discretionary income to go out. Also, I think, and, you know, and not to engage in like broad generalities, but I think historically women were always the ones who stayed home, who organized the house, who took care of, you know, the budgeted things. And so with that socialization, I think we're naturally more cautious. So even if we have extra money, we're more cautious with it than to go out and, you know, it might seem extravagant to us to go out and spend a couple hundred dollars on a night of drinking. Whereas for men, that's not an issue. You know what I mean?
I understand.
But
I think that maybe to that, together with the whole, social media going on and people meeting other ways than meeting at a bar is part of that. But it seems like your bar has really been a community place. I know it's in the West Village. Was it on West 12th Street, I think you said?
West 12th, yeah.
Yeah.
The corner of West 12th and 4th.
West 12th and 4th Street. So it's an essential location. It's a good New York City location for sure. Maybe tell us also how you got to run the bar and own the bar.
Well, it's funny how, you know, your life takes you on these circuitous paths that you never dreamt that you'd be doing. When I went to college, I always thought I wanted to be a social worker or a psychologist, account something. And I majored in sociology. I got my BA in sociology. And I started working as a probation officer, you know, trying to help young people that found themselves in trouble in family court. And I enjoyed that for the first couple of years, but then it started to change. Their policies started to change where they were more interested in expedience and quantity than they were in quality. And I started kind of getting a little bit disillusioned and burnt out from it. So my intention had been to go back to get my master's in social work. But I thought, you know, let me just take a year break and really figure this out and see if that's really what I want to do before I commit myself to that. And so I did that. I had always bartended on and off, you know, to earn a little bit of extra money. I had a friend who was working at the Cubbyhole, and it was, you know, a place that I had gone to socially. And she was leaving. She was moving to Florida. And she introduced me to the owner, and we got on. And I started working there in early 2001. And I fell in love with the place, with it, with its patrons, with its ambiance, with its owner, with its almost magical ability to make people who come there feel connected on the emotional level. It's an extraordinary place. It truly is. And so I worked there as a bartender for about 7 or 8 years, became the manager, and then the original owner became ill, and I sort of ran it for her for a few years. And then when she passed away 3.5 years ago, she left it to me to continue.
Oh, wow. Well, that must have felt good.
It's sort of bittersweet in a way, because I adored her. And she was like just an amazing woman in so many ways, such a like a pillar of the community, truly. And so losing her was hard. But I was glad that she left me, because she knew that I would continue it on in her vision and with her legacy. So I think that had a lot to do with it. But yeah, I mean, I was happy for that.
So Let's go back a little bit. When you said you were coming out as being gay, and is it just in terms of the nomenclature of saying gay and lesbian, is me not being gay, but having been a part as an actor working in some, I may have told you this when we spoke before, I've worked in a gay play and a movie that dealt with gay guys and been around, and being as an actor, there's a lot of gay people in acting. So I became accustomed to being around gay people. When someone says gay these days, does it mean a man, or does it, for that, it might be a simple, you know, you should know that already, whether you say gay or lesbian, but.
I think, well, to me, gay, I like the word gay. So I interpret it as meaning both.
Okay.
The lesbian community, I think a lot of younger lesbians have taken back, like to take back the epithets that people used to throw at us, like dyke. So they like to be called dyke. They like to be called queer.
Okay.
And then you add into it this new gender fluidity. And right. A lesbian is female, so they might not associate, be a female, but they may not want to be associated with either gender. So calling them a lesbian is actually, you know, not who they are. So it gets a little bit confusing. But I name myself, I like gay.
Okay. So when you came out as being gay, what was that like for you? How old were you?
I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I had always known, I guess it was, my family, I grew up in a sort of working class Italian Catholic neighborhood. And that was my family as well. My parents divorced when I was 10, and I was raised mostly by my mother, but with a lot of extended family that lived like just a few blocks away. So they all contributed into the raising part of my sister and I. But my mom has a gay sister, my aunt, and she was like a real activist. She was really in the, and this was like the 70s before it was cool. And I have to say, I am so lucky with my family because they accepted my aunt back then. And they totally embraced me. And I know from hearing all different kinds of what people's journeys have been and what their experience has been, that is not, has not been the case, especially back then in the 70s and even earlier. In fact, the original owner, Tanya, she came out in the late 50s, and in the 60s, she met her partner, and both her partner's family and her family would have completely disowned them had they come out. So they ended up, they lived in the West Village, and they had two gay guys that lived upstairs from them that they became friends with. And they actually ended up legally getting married to each one of them, so that if when their family visited or if they had to do family functions, they went and with their husbands. Wow. But they actually had a full-on wedding. It was like a legal marriage, but that's the extent that they had to go to, you know? So I know that I'm really fortunate in that. It wasn't, but so with my family anyway, it wasn't easy though on a social level, because I had mostly straight friends at the time. So they were kind of, I wouldn't say they, like some of them kind of just blew me off, but I think most of them, even if they didn't quite understand it, they tried to. And, but it was difficult. It was difficult because I didn't have any, I had my aunt, but my aunt was really more of an activist than I am. I'm more reserved. Mm-hmm. So coming out, I was pretty much on my own to go and meet other gay people. And all my friends were straight. Except for one, I met this one gay boy that was, that became friends. But for the most part, I was kind of on my own. So
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Sorry, just because we have a commercial break coming up. So we'll come back to what we're talking about. We're with Lisa Menachino, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you interested in having a better relationship with yourself, others, and God? Greetings. I'm your host, Dr. George Andow, for the show, A Journey Through Into Awareness. On my show, we journey into the awareness that the mind of God is the true seat of our personal consciousness. We join together each Monday at 7 p.m., so tune in on Talk Radio NYC.
Did you know that nearly one in five adults in the U.S. battles mental illness? Hi, my name is Albert Dabba. I'm the host of the show Extra Inning. Extra Innings, I discuss the topics of wellness, mental health, and the experience of surviving multiple suicides within my family. Listen live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern to Extra Innings for discussions with sports figures, artists, mental health professionals, and many others. That's Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
We're talking with Lisa Menachino. She's the owner of The Cubby Hole, which is on West 12th in New York City. And The Cubby Hole is a lesbian bar. It's one of the only three left in New York City. So Lisa, we were just talking about when you came out when you were gay in the 20s and what it was like for you. So that was in, what year was that in about?
It was in the early 90s. So there was a lot going on too. There was still the AIDS crisis going on. And like I said, I had my one gay male friend who ended up passing away from AIDS. Yeah. And like I also mentioned that I was never activist like my aunt, but there was one time when I did get involved with them. ACT UP and fighting for the rights of people that were dying of the AIDS, because and here was another example. His family he was completely closeted, and when they found out, they disowned him. And I remember him in the hospital, you know, begging to see his mom because he was in pain. He was in pain. Still get choked up about it. And, you know, she wouldn't come because of his lifestyle. And I was so just enraged by that, that it brought me out of my shell to come and, you know, I have to do something. I mean, I don't know if I did anything, but I joined the Gay Men's Health Crisis. I did the marches. I did whatever I could, because that was horrible. That was horrible.
Yeah, it is a horrible thing. I knew a guy who was doing a lot of acting then and studying, and I had a girlfriend whose best friend was gay and he ended up dying to AIDS, but I got to know him well and he was a real sweet man. He was an excellent ballet dancer and he died of AIDS. And I also had a client of mine who is this great guy. He brought us so much business of, it was called Dance Olympus was the name of the place. And he was the manager and, his name was Richard DeSarno and just a lovely guy. I loved talking to him and, he got sick and died of AIDS. And, you know, being in the arts business, you do meet a lot of gay people. And, you know, I came into situations where men were attracted to me and, you know, I had to be polite and say, I'm not gay. And, you know, multiple, many, many times, especially when I did this gay play in a gay bar.
They assumed you were gay because you're in the gay club.
I was gay. And when the play ended, being that it was in a gay bar, so I assume most of the guys were gay there. My mother even came one the night. And I was swarmed at the end of the play by all these guys. And then one night I went out with the eldest guy of the cast to learn more about the gay scene. When we did about 12 performances, but after the first week, he said, why don't I go out and take you to a gay bar and show what it's like. And this was when, you know, I'd have to say it was in the 1980s or maybe late 70s. And the gay scene was really big on the Upper West Side, the Lower West Side. You know, you drive by and on a Sunday and there'd be guys out there with just a pair of jeans on or something. And I went with him to the gay bar and he said, let's dress up like we do in the play. And, you know, I was wearing leather and he was wearing a cowboy thing. And he said, there's a whole tradition here of like, if you have your handkerchief in a certain way, it means you're looking or not looking. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how I had it, but I do remember him going to the bathroom and I felt like a swarm of bees came on top of me. you know, and actually it felt nice that there were, you know, like there's people interested in me. But on the other hand, you know, I kept saying, no, I'm not gay and blah, blah, blah. And there were other incidences like that when I was acting in plays where there would be always an encounter with a gay guy and, you know, and I'd have to say, no, I'm not gay, you know. But I used to hang out. The author of the play was gay and we went to his house one night and he showed us all the paraphernalia that he had in his house, which was mentioned in the play. And to me, I mean, I'm just naturally a curious guy. And then there was an Al Pacino movie called Cruising that I did some extra work in, which was really nuts because people were protesting the movie because it was about this pathological killer who happened to be gay. And, you know, I don't know how many people probably read the script, probably very little, but the gay community felt that it was kind of like an anti-gay movie, that every guy who's gay is a pathological crazy man. So I think I worked on it two nights and the first night we couldn't shoot and they held us up at the one of the piers on the west side because there was all these protesters to the movie, you know, blowing their whistles. So we couldn't shoot because you couldn't have all the sound. So it wasn't until like 1 a.m. that we all went downtown to shoot. But in the meantime, they held us up at the pier and it became this huge party. Like, and I'm actually met a guy from high school that I didn't. And I'm dressed up in leather and he's dressed up in leather. And I say, Charles, Albert, what are you doing here? And then, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it turned out he was gay. I didn't know that. And I just, I'm not gay. I'm just acting in the movie. But everybody was bringing up drugs and this and that. So it was like a big party. And by the time we got to shoot, I'll never forget, like there was like, I don't know how many, at least 75 to 100 guys walking down like West 4th Street. And I felt like we were in a gang. And it's an Al Pacino movie. It wasn't no little schlocky movie. I think it was, I'm not correct, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was William Friedkin directed this movie. And, you know, we shot till like 5 a.m. or something. And I got in a poster that was on, that I didn't know this till my sister called me in LA and said, Albert, there's the movie Cruising playing, and there's a poster of you outside. I go, what? And she sent me a, well, no, she didn't send me a picture of it, but I was on, I don't remember how I saw it, but it's on, I'm on the album cover. There was a music soundtrack. So I still have that album cover of me, you know, leaning against the wall, being in leather.
You still have it?
Yeah.
Is it in your office there?
Yeah, I still have it. Wow. I would show it to you, but I wouldn't. I have all my, you know, my brother used to listen to classical music. I have all his records. I have all my records sitting right here, but I wouldn't know how to find it right now. But I'll send it to you. But but I made sure to find it. And like I always felt like, it's important to respect other people. And I wrote down some, well, I'm going to write some down, some thoughts about a blog about, you know, society, about what's going on today. There's so much division. There's always tragedies. There's always people who think they're right and people are wrong, whether it's just within a relationship, when people have a dispute about something, everyone's got their own background. You know, there's a lot of times where people just don't trust other people for whatever reason. And I think it usually goes back to family or failed marriages or failed relationships or own insecurities or whatever it is, because everyone has something that, you know, you grow up from and leave it and get through it. But maybe there's a remnant of it still in you. And, you know, I've worked as a, I told you, I did get an MSW degree and work as a therapist for 5 years and recently got a coaching degree because to get a license now is very difficult. And all the supervisors I had are no longer around because this is back in the late 70s. But I, like even today on the show, I said mental health advocate as opposed to a therapist because I'm actively, I did work with someone recently, but I'm actively not working as a therapist now. And I'm looking at possibly different films to maybe direct or produce or seeing what goes on there, as well as keeping on this podcast because I really enjoy meeting people from different backgrounds and hopefully gaining an audience that people can relate to. Because I think your story is a very relatable story. You know, I had a woman on last week who lost her husband after 18 and a half years to suicide. But it's not like she goes out and, you know, writes books about it or speaks to, you know, to people out in conventions or mental health things. She's just a woman that, which I think is probably more the average person, although I have interviewed people who've written books and, you know, very good books about being a therapist or being a healer or, you know, coming out and really speaking about mental health. But the reason why I enjoyed her so much, as well as the other people, it was because she just seemed like this could happen to anyone. And she seemed so real. And she was referred to me by someone. And she didn't even know that her husband tried to kill himself before she met him twice, until afterwards a friend told her. So there's so many things that happen in life with people that we don't know the facts until later. But many times we make up our decisions based on the little bit we know. And I think that's unfortunate, you know. So I think coming out being gay has got to be a really difficult thing, for particularly what family you come from and where you're from. But the question was asked to me, what if my son or woman or my daughter or woman came and said, you know, I'm gay. Well, you know, I had my father tell me if I went out with a non-Jewish woman and got serious with her, he would disown me. And it kind of felt like, I mean, it's a different thing, but it also hurt a lot. So I played my father in the film. And when I played that scene, it really hurt me because I kept thinking, what does it feel like to, what it must have felt like to him to say that to me, that I will disown you as a son because I'm going out with someone from not the same faith. Anyway, I think we have to take a break.
Okay.
So we'll be right back with Lisa Menachino and stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Hey, everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Wise Content Creates Wealth. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Friday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 2. They say content is king. Well, wise content rules the world. Every episode features tools and tips for content marketing and business people telling the wise content stories of that success. Tune in every Friday from 1 p.m. to 2 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, we're back with Lisa Mendocino and talking about her experience of owning the lesbian bar called the Cubbyhole in the city. I love the name the Cubbyhole. Where did that come? I know she started created the name the Cubbyhole, the former owner.
No, actually, when she first opened the bar, she opened it with a partner. And they named it DT Fat Cats, Debbie and Tanya's Fat Cats. And that partnership dissolved. And there was another lesbian bar called the Cubbyhole. And that lesbian bar expanded so that it was no longer a cubbyhole. So the owner of that bar changed the name. And the name became available shortly after the dissolution of the partnership that Tanya had. So she took that name and recreated the whole bar. And in 1994, she opened it as the Cubbyhole. So that's how that name came to be. And it is because it is a small space. It's a little bit over 500 square feet, I'd say, with a big personality.
Oh, wow. So it's a small little bar, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many tables do you have?
We have like a couple of bar tables, like the tall bar tables. And then we have about, I would say maybe 15 stools, mm-hmm. 15 to 20 stools, maybe.
Do you get to, since it's such a community place, it sounds like, do you get to know many of the people that are there? I kind of have a sense that you do.
Yes. That's what makes this bar so special, because how to explain this? It's a place where, you know, I don't want to use something trite like everybody knows your name, but it's true. I think, you know, you go in there, and if you go in there more than once or twice, people know who you are, because it's small and it's intimate, and it's an environment where you feel safe talking to the person next to you, even if you don't know them. Maybe that's because physically it's so small. But I think it's more the ambiance. Tanya always wanted to create a place that was a safe haven for lesbians, but also never unwelcome to other types of people, the friends of like gay men or transgender people or straight people or the person living across the street. She never wanted anyone to feel unwelcome. And it became like a little neighborhood icon for people to go. And she never, ever closed. In the 27 years they were open, she stayed open 9/11. She stayed open the Sandy, blackouts, blizzards. The only time it closed was March 16th for the pandemic. And she did that so that people who were experiencing like environmental stresses would have a place to come, even if it was just for a couple hours. And I think over the years, people came to really appreciate that because New York is a huge city, but it could be a very lonely place, as crowded as it is. I think, I live in Midtown, Hell's Kitchen, and I have about 100 apartments in my building, and I barely know any of my neighbors. And so you take this little bar, and it's like a small town plopped down in the middle of a huge city. And I think it reminds people of home sometimes. And I think through the years, people have appreciated that. And we make people feel special. Yeah. If I sent you a picture of the bar, I'm not sure, but there's all these things hanging from the ceiling. And Tanya got that idea on a trip somewhere. She saw something hanging from the ceiling, and she's a very superstitious person. And basically she felt that fish, ladybugs, frogs, and pigs were lucky. So that's what hung from the ceiling, along with vines at first. And then it sort of started to evolve where it changed with the seasons and the holidays. But behind the bar, people from all over the place would bring us souvenirs from their travels, and we would hang them up behind the bar. So we have tons of those, and we never change. Those like stay there until they fall off. So it's that kind of connection. A simple little thing like that makes people feel so special.
Well, what it seems to me, that it's a very warm, friendly atmosphere. I was going to ask you, and you just answered the question, like, if a straight person came in, are they welcome there?
Yes, everyone is welcome, as long as they're respectful. And yeah. It got a little, I have to say, though, again, one of the byproducts of being, open and out and accepted was I started to get requests to do bachelorette parties, straight women bachelorette parties. And I did a couple, but then I started to notice like they were just coming in like little bucket lists, things they wanted to do before they got married. One of them was make out with a girl, and it became kind of clownish, and it was like demeaning to the bar. So I stopped that. But as long as people are respectful, everybody's welcome.
Yeah. You know what I feel funny about when it's called a straight man? I just feel like a straight man means I'm straight, because I don't feel straight in my life. I feel like my life goes in all these kinds of circles. And I've been open to having talks with gay men all the time. Particularly ones that come up to me and say, I'm interested in you. And I say, well, listen, I'm sorry, I'm not gay. But it's a funny name because it's just, like I grew up feeling in my family kind of lost, and I had to find myself. And losing a brother and sister to suicide was very tough. And my other sister is extremely religious, Orthodox Jewish. So we're friendly, but we're pretty much night and day. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to see the movie Extra Innings. She finally saw it and never asked me about how it's doing or anything like that. And she had some objections to it, but she is who she is. I totally understood it. Matter of fact, when I was actually beginning to shoot it, she goes, don't shoot it. Someone told me about that. Someone's already talking about it and you didn't even shoot it yet. I go, well, that's good. And But I felt this need to fit in, and it was hard for me to fit in anywhere. Even though I grew up in a small Jewish, Syrian Jewish community that's very tight, and my best friends are still from that community. But, you know, I was always trying to analyze what's going on in my family and feeling alone and left out. And I spoke to this old therapist that I saw the other day. I haven't seen her in, you know, virtually in over a year and a half, but I had seen her for like 11 years. And I had something I wanted to talk to her about. And she said something to me like that she had never said before. She goes, "You were really abandoned by your family," because I'm the youngest and the Orthodox sister is 5 years older than me. And the two brothers and sisters that took their lives were 10 and 12 years older than me. And she goes, "You were basically abandoned by your family. You were left to yourself to, you know, figure it out. And you were really the glue of the family." And I never saw it that way. But as I mentioned to my friend today, she said, "You analyze a lot." Well, I grew up having to figure out what was going on in my life, in my family. And there was a lot of love. I used to do a lot of talks when we showed the film before COVID and all these different festivals. And I was asked once, "How did you deal with such a mean father?" And I said to him, it's funny how people watch the film had different perceptions. And I said, "I never felt he was mean. I just felt he, you know, was old fashioned and he had a culture that he came from that he totally believed in. I disagreed with him. He was extremely stubborn, but that's who he was." And what grounded me was baseball. And that's how I got to make the film, calling it Extra Innings, because that gave me a grounding of something that my brother not taught me physically, but talked about it. It was the only thing he ever talked to me about. And I felt connected to it. And when I started playing, I was always athletic and loved playing. And not only loved playing, when I started playing outside of my community, you know, I played with all ethnic groups and I felt special because I went to yeshiva, private, you know, Jewish school. It was all Jewish, not all Orthodox, but mostly. And I'll never forget, the best guy on the team was this big black guy named Al. My name's Al. They called him Big Al. Mm-hmm. Bigger than me. He was like 6'2", and he threw really hard. And I felt such a great feeling having a catch with him before every game we warmed up. We found this little friendship together. And it made me feel included into something that a game that I began to love. And then my dream was to be a baseball player, which is not unusual for anyone who goes into playing baseball when they're young. I asked the coach who I had on the show the other day, I said, "Jerry, who still coaches this Bonnie team from kids, I don't know what their age, they start when they're young and he goes to when they're 20, 21. I go, "How many kids come to play with you and dream about being a baseball player?" His answer was every single one. And my question was, "How do you deal with the fact that they're, you know, most of them don't?" And his response was great. He goes, "Like what I try," he goes, "they really see that when they try to get into a college that's a top baseball college when they're getting rejected." And he always tries to build their confidence up that, you know, this is a tough game and very few people make it to the top. But that doesn't mean you don't try. And it helps you in so many other ways. And it helped me learn about sportsmanship, learn about being with other people, you know, whether they're from different religions, different cultures, whether they're gay or not gay, whether whoever they are, to always got to, you know, try to keep an open mind about whoever I meet. I mean, obviously, you know, my friend asked me today, if someone said something about me that was true, but, you know, maybe I didn't give it out in the open, would you be upset? I said, not really. I mean, I'm pretty much open about stuff unless it was meant to be to hurt me, if there was a reason, but I'm not really, I don't feel, I mean, there might be something that might be embarrassing if someone felt something about me, but I don't have any deep-hearted secrets. And that's one of the reasons why I made the movie, was because it was important for me to get out what I felt was a secret growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about mental illness, talking about my brother. Anyway, we got to take a break and we'll be right back with Lisa. Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, we're back with Lisa Menachino, owner of the Cubby Hole, one of the three last lesbian bars in New York City. So, Lisa, what was it like yesterday with Gay Pride Weekend or Gay Pride Month and all the celebration? I saw some of the news yesterday. It looked like a huge party. Tell me what it was
incredible. It was you know, especially after this year and after last year when we didn't have any parade. I mean, they just came out and supported us. I mean, we had lines around the block all weekend long, and it just, after the struggle of this past year, it just like filled me up with such like wonderment. At how much and you know what really was incredible was people would wait online. They were waiting online. Some of them brought lounge chairs because they knew they were going to wait 2 or 3 hours to get in. It was like I said, it's a small bar, and you know what, we called last call around 3:30 a.m. and there was still a line, and so you have to go to the end of the line and you say, you know what, I know you've been waiting a while, but you're probably not going to get in. And they were like, we don't care. We're just going to stay here because there might be a chance we might get in. And I was like, oh, wow. My God.
Thank you so much. Feeling. Wow. Really?
Yes. It's such a great feeling. It's such a great feeling. So yeah, it was an incredible Gay Pride weekend and Sunday.
Yeah, that's amazing to have a place like that, that people feel that way, that they want to, you know, come and congregate and feel at home and feel like a great social place to be. I mean, no matter what kind of place it is, but the fact that it's there's only two other lesbian bars in the city, mm-hmm. for women to be able to go and congregate and feel at home, I think that's really special.
And I had not realized until, I mean, I always knew it was special and it meant a lot to people, but when I was closed and, you know, trying to figure it out, how I was going to reopen, you know, I was starting to get all these messages about how many of these people actually celebrating milestones in their lives there. I was, you know, I met my husband, I met my wife there. I met my, you know, I had my first kiss there. I came out there. I had, it was the last place we went before my partner died. I mean, all these really heart-wrenching, touching things, and like, you know, offering their support, and like, you have to reopen, you have to like, it almost, the board almost transcends its edifice for so many people. There's an emotional connection. It's a magical place. And I don't just say that because I own it and I love it, but it truly is. For a lot of people, it truly is.
Yeah. I definitely get that feeling from you. And I think that, it's, I mean, Mark is your, uncle.
Yes. He's married to my Aunt Fran.
Oh, okay. So Mark, who I played baseball with on the Bonnies, recommended you for the show, and that's how I met you. I feel it's great to have a place like that. You know, whatever place it is, the fact that it's a lesbian bar is one thing. It's great. But, you know, anytime there's a place that people can feel that kind of warmth and loving about it, to have their first this there, their first that there. And it does make it special that it is a lesbian bar, because, you know, there's such discrimination about so many things in this world. And it almost seems like it grows, not to be negative about it, but there just seems to be, maybe it's not growing, but I'm not a Trump fan. With the age of Trump, there was so much diversity going on, and still, you know, the guy still thinks he won the election.
I know. I mean, you kind of, living in New York, you kind of get cocooned sort of in this little progressive enclave, and you forget, I think, the rest of the world out there, and just how much it is still a struggle for so many people who don't live, you know, on the coasts, and how difficult it still is for them.
Yeah, there was a piece that I saw in the news last night about transgenders who coming from different countries, and how they feel safe here at one of the homes they were talking about. And, you know, I mean, New York is a special place. I mean, it's obviously known for a place like a melting pot. I remember growing up, it always had a melting pot of people, and it really is. And I think that's what makes it real special. I don't live in the city. I did live in the city for about 10 years, and I love living there. And I know how you feel about, you could feel alone, like, because I knew some people in the building, but not that many. But, you know, I had some friends, and, you know, I had a girlfriend for a while there, and, you know, you became a great home for me. And then my daughters moved there. They don't move. They live in Los Angeles. And my son moved there, and now he lives in Fort Lauderdale. But I lived there with my ex-wife for 1 or 2 years, and then we moved out to the suburbs and had kids. But my office is there. It's on West 29th Street. But because of COVID, you know, I only go there once, twice a week. And I'm, you know, in the midst of deciding whether to renew my lease and what I'm going to do with the place and all that. But I think that what you have there is a gem, to use the word that I think is a very special word, because any place that people can come and feel so warm and welcome and have their first whatever there, or their last whatever there, is a special place. And I think the fact that there's only 3 in the whole New York City is quite astounding, because there's so many people in New York City.
I know. Yeah, it's crazy. It truly is. And just to add about the connection with Cubby, I had like so many volunteers. Like, we have our outdoor seating, and that was built by a regular who was a carpenter, and she got 5 of her lesbian carpenter friends, and they built me this structure. It's beautiful. I had an artist who wrote to me who wanted to paint it so that it looked like it might have painted flowers on the window, Cubby. They wanted to paint the outdoor seating so that it resembled that. And I had another person that was a plant designer, and she wanted to volunteer to make the ceiling, the things hanging from the ceiling, hanging the little, it's such a great place. It means a lot to a lot of people. And the other, you know, I don't want to, Henrietta's is the other lesbian bar, Henrietta's and Ginger's. And, you know, they're an important historical places where I'm sure, you know, the equally there's a lot of people connected to them, maybe in a little different way than they are with Cubbyhole, because they're bigger, they're more like a dance place and that sort of thing. So, but, you know, I was the only one that was able to open last summer. Henrietta's just recently opened. And the third one, Ginger's, has yet to reopen. So, you know, it's tough.
But, well, I want to say something, that you seem to have so much passion for the place. And I'm sure people pick that up all the time, and warmth about it. And that makes a big difference, you know, owning whatever you own, particularly a bar, I would think. And it's, you know, the fact that it's a lesbian bar, which is, you know, not the largest part of a population, but you would, but other people can come. I would love to visit one night.
Yeah, you have to come.
Yeah, I would, you know, come and say hi and visit, because it sounds like you've done a great job there. And, you know, maybe just let everyone know exactly where it is so they could visit.
It's 281 West 12th Street. It's between Greenwich Avenue and West 4th.
Okay, great. So you all heard that. And I want to end by just saying thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And remind everybody that Extra Innings, the movie that I made, is on Amazon Prime. Please see it when you have a chance. It really is about family and love and how to find your own way. And if you like it, or even if you don't like it, you can rate it, because it helps to get good ratings or ratings. Anyway, thank you so much, Lisa, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
One day. And, all right. Be well. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
So I got started.
Nice.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host the program Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Wise Content Creates Wealth. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Friday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 2. They say content is king. Well, wise content rules the world. Every episode features tools and tips for content marketing and business people telling the wise content stories of that success. Tune in every Friday from 1 p.m. to 2 on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, all you listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talk Radio NYC with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply send us a message on our website, talkradio.nyc.
Do you love, or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Bye.